At the Table with Tony is brought to you by Trafe Hustlin'. That's www.traifhustlin.com. Your home for all things barbecue. Welcome to At the Table with Tony. My name is Anthony Scilia, better known as Tony Mangia. And today we have our eighth episode of the live stream edition of the At the Table with Tony show. And I'm very happy and pleased to be joined by a couple of my friends. We have Father Edmund Luciano. He's a parochial vicar of St. Bernard of Clairvaux and master of Episcopal ceremonies in the Diocese of Metuchen. We're also being joined by Eric Lavin. He's a high school Italian teacher and authority on Italian and Catholic traditions. And of course, last but not least, Patrick O'Boyle. He's a co-host of the Italian American podcast, and he's a recurring guest here on the At the Table with Tony show. So gentlemen, thank you so much for taking time out to come on the show tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Again, it's my pleasure to have you here. So our topic this evening is Italian and Italian-American Holy Week traditions and how we can keep and or adapt these traditions while under quarantine. So we are on Wednesday. Today's Wednesday, I think. I'll tell you, it just feels like it's been one long Lent. I actually posted this on Facebook. I posted this on Facebook earlier today. Like that, really, this is, for me, I don't know about how you guys could talk about this. This has been the realest Lent I've probably ever experienced in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. It's felt like Good Friday for 2 weeks.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously we are in the middle of this pandemic and the numbers are getting, they say they're getting better, but then you look at other numbers, the deaths particularly, they are rising. So really it's, I don't know, maybe it's apropos that we are in Holy Week and these numbers are the way they are because we really are merging our suffering with Christ on the cross. But obviously, the one constant in all of this is Christ.
Right. That's what, when you look at the mystery of Holy Week, that's what it's supposed to be, is how is this working, this mystery, this Paschal mystery, working itself out in our life? You know, it's not, at Christmas, we have the pageants, right? So we mimic. We mimesis in Greek, we remember. This Holy Week is very different. It's supposed to be about us living it. It's a mysterious way, but we live it. So yeah, this is probably the most profound Holy Week that we would have. I would, you know, all of us being remotely in the same age. Please God, you know, it's the most profound Holy Week. It doesn't get any worse.
Fulton Sheen said it best. You can't have an Easter Sunday without a Good Friday.
Absolutely.
That's a great point. So how have you, Eric, been feeling or been doing through this Lenten period?
Well, honestly, I must say, I've used the time in quarantine as a time of renewal, both spiritually and physically. I go on crazy long walks now, obviously by myself, for miles and miles. But I really found it as a time for me to, you know, to get back into the rosary, which I confess in front of Father Ed, that I had not been saying regularly. But I mean, just praying every day, you know, and I'm sure Father will tell you, the best prayer is meditate, like talking to God, your that conversation with God, leaving things in his hands and just telling him, you know, that which troubles you. But I've really used this time really to focus back in on the rosary and watch Mass and watch other things on EWTN. I subscribe to the Italian channel, so now I get to see some things on that end, which is also great, in terms of all the shrines that they show. So just, you know, just really trying to find a good balance, a good wholesome balance of, you know, physical, spiritual, you know, mental progress.
Look, you can't be, you know, taking care of only one part of yourself. You know, the human being is a being, right? So when we are physically challenged, then, you know, our spirit either lifts us up or our spirit is challenged. Everything has to be a holistic balance. So, you know, if we have this opportunity, really, you know, I remember the best retreat I ever went on was the Camino. All the walking was, you know, let me pray in a very focused way, right? Because I didn't have the distraction. So I'm sure that Eric's walks, I mean, those are sometimes the best ways to pray the rosary, right? Because you sit still and you've got too much energy, I think most of us in the 21st century, you know? So like Catholics, we kneel, we smell, we see, we move. You know, so our body is meant to be involved in our prayer, right? When we watch our Orthodox Jewish brothers and sisters, especially if you watch them, you know, at the Western Wall, they're always moving, right? Because they're praising God with their whole self.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that goes into, you know, why do we fast? Why do we do this? Why do we do? Because the whole person, right? It's not, you know, we've already dealt with this question in the past. We're not two different entities, right? Body and soul. Body or soul. We're body and soul. They're meant to be together. What are we looking forward to at the end of this week? Christ's bodily resurrection. Right? So at the we say it every Sunday, I believe in the resurrection of the dead. We are waiting to share fully in Christ's resurrection at the end of time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all these things that we finally have the opportunity now for most of us to not worry about running around, but to do things slower, to do things in a more focused way. I think that, you know, this is some of the great gift, you know, because God, I don't think, God, we know God doesn't cause evil, but we know God brings good out of evil because that's how he shows his power. I think this is one of the good.
Mm. But, you know, you mentioned that, you know, bringing good out of the evil. And you think about it, this is really this whole pandemic has really tried our patience because if we're stuck in quarantine with whether it's our wife, husband, kids, it could really test the patience. It could test, you know, how do you go out into a world that isn't what it was a month ago? How do we now go to a store? We have to wear gloves. We have to wear masks. How do we encounter other people by still being present to them, but yet being socially distant? I mean, I think that is something that is, especially for an Italian-American or an Italian.
Oh, yeah.
We love to be around people. We love to break bread. We love to drink a glass of wine, have a cup of coffee. You know, we can't do what we're used to doing. So can you guys speak to that a little bit? Pat, you want to comment on that?
In what sense?
No, just saying how it changes everything that we've known.
I'll put it this way. I think it has brought us back to what the world has always been like. We've been really, really lucky,
right,
that since the polio was kind of taken under control, and if you want to go further back a little to the Spanish influenza, the idea of a plague popping up out of nowhere every generation, or even much more frequently, and devastating a population to where 50% of a town are killed, 50% of the human population are killed. Some towns are almost totally wiped off the face of the earth.
Hmm.
We've been spared that globally for over a century. And I think that this has kind of brought us back to how the natural cycle of life went. And I think that, you know, I was saying to someone one time, you know, and I don't know if I'm answering your question.
You're making a good point. It's a good point.
These people, we were talking about why did the feasts and the processions and why the kind of devotion where someone would get on a, would leave their house in Brooklyn and walk all the way to East Harlem, like 20 miles barefoot and through the night to go to the Shrine of Our Lady of Mount Carmel in East Harlem. What kind of infused that type of devotion? And I think for a long time, people try to argue, well, you know, that was a devotion of ignorance. You know, people who didn't know any better. But really, it was a devotion of dependence of people who were really aware of how much little control they had on the world or on their lives.
Right.
And I think that humanity, for the last half century, has kind of bamboozled itself to think that it has a better control on things than it really does.
Hmm.
Because this wasn't supposed to happen, right? This was supposed to be part
of it. I agree
100%. And I think that if you listen to some of the analysis that's been done, I guess it was, I'm not sure on the dates, was SARS around in 2002, 2008?
Yeah, 2008. I think 8, right?
Right. Yes. So if you take 12 years ago, you know, with H1N1 and with those flus then, where people in the medical field were like, oh no, here comes 1918 all over again. For a lot of different reasons, the medical community was able to get their hands around those diseases, which seemed to have been less problematic. And they didn't turn into full-fledged pandemics. The same way we had to fear that Ebola was going to come and cause the same thing. So I think that there was a hubris that came out of that, that, you know, H1N1, the avian bird flu, Ebola, you know, medical professionals with all the right degrees, with funding from major, you know, first world countries were able to go in and wrestle it so that we weren't affected.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, it didn't happen. So I've seen people who kind of like, I've seen people who were kind of dismissive, not a lot, but some people who were kind of dismissive of the old ways of religion, stuff like that, all of a sudden becoming a little bit more pious now that the plague has hit. And some people call it hypocrisy. And I don't think hypocrisy is fair. I just think that this has given people a little greater clarity, because, you know, some people in life, they have, their lives have changed because they have tragedy. They have tragic death that sends them for a tailspin, and they have to try to figure life out. Some people, they've had, you know, grandma lived to be 103. She was senile for the last 10 years, so it was like she died gradually a long time ago. They have to call from the nursing home, and life goes on. It's very different than someone in their 20s who dies from cancer.
Mm.
And I think that this is more the former than the latter. This is more of the shock. And we've had a universal collective shock where the whole world is able to say, we really don't have our hands on the wheel. And I think that that has driven home that we're not as smart as we think we are. And I think that that has kind of brought us more in touch. So I think there's a part of the, that if you want to talk about the Italian spirituality, I think that these are the type of events that kind of bring us back to what our spiritual roots really are, unfortunately.
But sometimes you need that. You need a, what do they say? You need a swift kick in the pants to kind of get you back to realize it isn't about me. It isn't about being on the phone 24/7. It's about number one, it's about God. Number, you know, it's about our relationship with God. And I think, again, I keep on beating the same drum, but, you know, for this to happen this time of year in this liturgical season, for it to happen in America, one of the lesser religious countries, I think it really, like you said, Patrick, this is, you know, it's like put up or shut up. You either have to come back to the faith, or I don't know. I mean, what do you think, Father?
Well, I never liked correcting people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a necessary part of my job. So we are one of the more religious countries. I know that.
I agree with that 100%.
Yeah, it doesn't seem it because of the product that the news media puts out there.
That's fair.
But if you look at, you know, how many people say they believe in God, how many people go to Mass, it's not good because it's not 100%. But we're ahead of Europe. You know, we're ahead of other first world countries. That gives me hope. You know, there's different numbers, but they're off topic. But I would say we're on a strong high end of an average in terms of religious belief. Patrick, when he was talking, I was reminded of the phrase, and I'm trying to remember who I can attribute it to. There are no atheists in foxholes. Right? Another way of saying that is the way that I always impose ashes of the two options on Ash Wednesday. Remember, O mortal, you are dust, and unto dust you will return. It's not you might, it's not you could, you will. Right? So, you know, this has shown us something of a lesson of humility. Right? Humility is not this silent virtue where we beat ourselves up and don't pretend we're not good at anything and we don't have any talent. Humility is when we recognize the truth, right? So as Patrick said, as you said, this has been a lesson in humility in that we have seen who, you know, where is the real power? It's not in me. It's not in what I want. That is such a painful conversion for the human person to make. It's a violent tearing away of the self. And, you know, when we talk about Jesus getting ready for Good Friday, we would call it a kenosis, the self-emptying, right? Well, that will be the second reading on Good Friday. It was the second reading on Palm Sunday. You empty yourself. Jesus, though he was in the form of God, did not deem equality with God something to be grasped at. It was within his ability, it was within his right, but he chose to live fragilely so that he would share our death for the purpose of us sharing his life, right? Mm-hmm. And we look at it, it's not so that we will never die. The body will eventually do what the body is going to do. That's what theologically we say, that's what death has done. That what sin has done. Death is a reality, not that we have invoked, that we have made, but it's not a creation, part of God's creation. But here it is, that even if the body dies, our life doesn't end. Mm-hmm. When we're baptized, our eternal life begins, right? Our eternal life is not another life that we pick up at baptism, at our death, right? We don't wake up as something else. What God preserves in us as he created us at our baptism, that's what continues to live. That because as much as we say traditionally that baptism washes away original sin, I always think instead of baptism taking something away, baptism fills in something that we've been missing.
Hmm.
The only way it makes sense to me, it fills in what we were missing. You know, so it's the charge of the battery, right? Christ fills us in with himself. The Father can't see us without seeing through Christ to us, right? We are kind of grafted onto him.
Hmm.
So that speaks to what your question was, that many ethnic groups have the same virtue. Italians, I think, are particularly well known for it, of community, familia, right? How do we do that now? I think this is where the Italian-American experience of holidays kind of does save us a little bit. At least, let me be specific, my family, what I was brought up with, because, language, they say, the first thing to go, food, the last thing to go. Talking about immigrants, right? Thanks be to God for that, because if anybody listening is like me, you need something to do. Right? We all know how to talk, everybody understands us, but I need something to do, Sebastian Maniscalco was funny, if you remember, because today starts Passover for our Jewish brothers and sisters. He had a great skit where he was, his wife is Jewish. He's an Italian-American comedian out of Chicago. And he said, I sat down for my first Passover. I'm Italian. I need a piece of bread and a bowl of oil. In 30 seconds, I got to start dipping. Right? So we got to have something to do. And he goes, and they gave me reading material. But anyway, Passover is. So this time of year, when you asked me to be on the show, Tony, the first thing I thought of was the Easter bread, the papus. So I know that my mother and my father are home right now. Thanks be to God, they love each other passionately, which, can be scary if you're not used to Italian, a good Italian relationship, because just because we're loud doesn't mean that we're angry. Mother's braiding the bread, she's dyeing the eggs. My father's sitting in the kitchen keeping her company. They have this little enclave of themselves. So we have things to do, right? We have the spinach pies to make for Good Friday. We have the bread to make. We've got the different cookies. What do we do in terms of not having, to be able to reach out to each other? Well, we have things, the pizza gain or the pizza rustica, depending on what you like. Pat has that whole Facebook page on that.
I've turned it to a lifestyle.
Because
it's now a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's a lifestyle product. It's a lifestyle brand.
It is. Yeah, I look forward to it every year. This is the only time we have it. So thanks God that we have these things to do. And nobody ever makes it for themselves, right? Because if I make one, I got to make 25. Because, Zia needs one. And then this cucina, this amico. and then if it's anything like my house, you have to make 5 extra because what if I forgot? So, yes, it's hard.
Could I just jump into the
oh, please.
The clerical? We have saved frozen pizza games and bastidas for emergency situations.
Yeah.
And this is an emergency situation.
Absolutely.
We froze some last Easter, and it's like the lifeboat on the Titanic. You hope you never have to use it, but when you do, it comes in handy.
You know, and exactly. So we can make them now. We can share them. You know, there's all the these things that we can do while thinking about other people, right? So we have something to do. We have people to do it for. It's things are put off a little bit, but they're, you know, Easter's not canceled, right? Our life is different temporarily, right? So I feel bad for people that aren't like my parents that have each other. That's the people I feel bad for, right? But we live in a time where, look at what we're doing now. You know, you're on YouTube, we're on Zoom, but you know, we have to find ways to reach out to people. You know, all of the kids that are writing messages in front of, on the streets. I don't know about your students, Eric, because they're probably a little older. My religious ed kids, they go around in the neighborhood and they write messages to people that they know live alone on their driveways and stuff with chalk.
I've been seeing that a lot. I've been seeing, even in town, walking, I've been seeing a lot of, even putting messages in the window too. Yeah. But even common everyday people that are thinking, you know, thinking these first responders, thinking our, you know, everybody from sanitation workers all the way up to nurses and doctors. I mean, we gotta really seize the opportunity to be more grateful, to be more appreciative.
And these kind of things that they're doing, putting the signs in the window, this kind of came out of Italy, right? Which they were obviously hit terribly in the beginning.
Right. And I think, you know, Tony, this speaks to your question. I mean, Italians need a way to express themselves, right, Pat? If you got to give them a soapbox to say something, to do, everybody has to put in their twos, and Italians need to express themselves, whether it's love or anger or hatred or fear, whatever the case is, an Italian always has to express themselves. And I think they gave a great example to the whole world. People singing, dancing in Spain, who's doing exercises on the rooftop. I mean, and
you know, funny though, can I just jump in?
Go ahead.
I know you're half Spanish and half Italian. The Italians were banging drums and singing out their balconies, and then they went inside to eat. And in Spain, they were exercising.
It's different, you know, they got to work it off.
They're like, Spain is more like it's a disciplined. The Italians, like, you know, Italy, everybody kept going out shopping. Everybody was eating. And
my grandmother is 87. She's living in Spain on her own, healthy as an ox. God bless her. Every day at 7 o'clock, she goes out in the parking lot and she dances. And the neighbors take a video of her. And every day I get my daily update. It's my grandmother dancing.
You know, they're on his Facebook. It's great.
Right, exactly. You know, we're adapting Facebook, that, you know.
I hope at the end of this that, you know, what it really brings, you know, the challenges of a little bit of loneliness, the challenge of all that is we don't take for granted the times that we are together, the times that, you know, I'm not reaching out because I don't feel like it. I hope that this builds a community out of us, because here's the American part of the Italian American is that I think that a lot of times, you know, we're falling into that social media anonymous problem where I'm on my phone and I don't communicate with the people that are actually around me, right? So what I'm really hoping, what I'm praying is, you know, that's a blessing that comes out of it is, Lord, let me appreciate the people that are around me, the people that I can talk to, that I don't need any, you know, broadcasting means or Wi-Fi means or things like that. I almost, you know, anybody that's younger than me is going to shoot me for saying this, but, you know, the only thing, so this is good in the sense of being at home with people. I've, you know, so many of my parishioners I've been keeping in touch with, they're like, this is wonderful. I mean, it's sad, but that there's this beautiful thing coming out of it. You know, this is what people are going to be like, oh, he's crazy. I almost wish the Wi-Fi would have gone down too. You know? So many of my parishioners said, because we're trying to keep our parish, what our people are doing, aside from what the priests are doing sacramentally, you know, people sending in videos, people sending in pictures of what they're doing in this. so that there is that sense of community. And you see them playing cards, you see them sitting and talking and doing things together that they just felt so rushed they couldn't do before.
Mm-hmm. That's so, a good point.
You know, it's the pace of life, you know, it's kind of like putting a perspective on everything. That again, humility, truth, perspective. These, you know, so those are the blessings I'm praying for out of this.
But you know, so this is a good segue to talk a little bit about the traditions or the liturgical traditions of Holy Week, because we are in the thick of Holy Week now. This is Wednesday. So traditionally, it's just called Spy Wednesday, correct?
Spy Wednesday.
This is when Judas would have sold out Jesus, right, for the 30 pieces of silver. Would have been on the Wednesday evening?
Correct.
No, Wednesday during the day, before the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So during the day. And it's really... you know, we say 30 pieces of silver, and we hear 30, and we don't think that's a high number. Let me give you a perspective on this. It's about $200. I've spent that much on a good celebratory dinner.
Yeah.
You know, Judas sold out Jesus basically for a nice meal, right? But I always wonder what made Judas get to that point, right? So when we look at... but I don't want to go too far down that road because I'll give my homily from this morning. This is Holy Week, right? So we start with Palm Sunday with Jesus coming down the Mount of Olives. That it's a very steep hill, you know. I would love to, you know, one day we're all going to go, right? But it's a very steep hill. And I remember walking down it the first time, and I thought to myself, no wonder why he needed a donkey. He needed something that was very sure-footed on a mountain, right? So it's this very steep hill. It would have been a campsite. It's where all, you know, you would have had 2.5 million people come in Jerusalem for Passover. At the same time that Jesus is coming in from the north and the west, Pilate is coming from Caesarea Marmatime. You know, every shore town, you know, is like prime real estate. That's what it was there. So you've got a prince of the world representing, you know, earthly power coming to the city of God to remind those people that they have been invaded and that they're under that thumb. Here comes Jesus, the Prince of Peace, into the city on the other side and declaring a liberty, saying, no, here is one brings captivity, one brings freedom, one brings aggression, swords, the other one comes in peace with palms. You know, so we're really, so the first mystery you encounter on Holy Week is that we are, what Jesus says, you're in the world, but you are not of the world, right? So creation is for our benefit, but it's not for, it's so that we know God's goodness. So we encounter that first conflict. Today, in a way, it continues, because when we look at what Judas is doing, he's buying into the world, right? So here it is the contrast of what Jesus is going to do. Jesus is going to, instead, you know, of Judas taking control, of Judas wanting what he wants, enforcing things along with the chief priests, which I think, by the way, you see with $200, right? Does that sound like an amount of money that says, yeah, I really need you to do this for me? Yeah, I mean, it's barely a tip, right? You know, good job. It's less than hush money. Not that I know anything about that. So I don't know if Judas was even a necessary part of the chief priest's plan, which also shows us more of how much Judas was being taken in by the other side. So we have to be very careful that we're not taken in, that we're not being bought out ourselves for cheap things compared to what is available. And then we enter, you know, the Triduum, the sacred 3 days, one liturgy, starting Thursday, moving fluidly into ideally we don't do it anymore, but moving ideally into the morning of Easter, that you can't take apart the Paschal mystery. It's that one motion, you know. When you look at Lent, first, you know, you take away the Alleluia, you take away music, then you get to Passion Sunday, you take away the images, then, you know, we're into Holy Week, and we take away even, you know, the Eucharist at the end of the Holy Thursday liturgy. Jesus is taken out of the tabernacle, brought to another place, and even there at the end of the night, the priest comes and takes him away, and he's not there on Good Friday. And then even on, so then there's no Mass. You know, more and more is taken away in our experience of this mystery, even to the point of our sight being lost in the darkness of the tomb on Holy Saturday night, only to be relit by the resurrection of Christ.
Amen.
It's a profound experience when we enter into this mystery, not just as a Sunday hobby, but as this is the week that helps us understand what living our baptism means, you know, in this one mysterious sense. So those are some of the liturgical pieces, right? So I think I talked a lot. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's great, Father. It's also good to give people, in case people watching this don't have no idea what Holy Week is or have no idea what a Triduum is, this is a good foundation to kind of teach people and to bring them into, kind of bring up to speed of what we practice as Roman Catholics. But one of the things that I think is one of the most beautiful, I guess it's my favorite part of the Triduum, is to be able to visit churches on Holy Thursday after the Mass or the Lord's Supper. So we would go to usually always Wallington. We would always go to Wallington, and of course every other churches in between. But for me this year, that's something that I am going to miss tremendously, because it was able to really be able to experience even other cultures to a certain extent. Because when you go to Wallington, that was the Polish church, and they go all out. Have you ever been to Wallington's?
I've seen it.
Yeah,
I've seen pictures. Probably your pictures. Now that I'm thinking about it, but we've got in Manville, just down the road from me. I'm in Bridgewater. There's a large Polish population. That's pretty much the accent of our parish there, you know, and they even have Jesus behind bars.
Yes.
The icon of Jesus in jail. So, so I know what you mean. But they do it up in the parish you're talking about in Wallington. That's a massive, it's like a set construction. I mean, the Metropolitan Opera could probably take a lesson out of it.
Father Steve said that once the Triduum and everything is done for this year, they start planning how they're going to decorate it for the next year.
So I believe it.
Yeah, they're constantly working on that. So maybe Patrick, can you talk a little bit to that? That's also an Italian tradition as well, correct? About visiting the churches, usually what, 7 or 12 or 13, depending on the different number?
Yeah, that was in the pre-55 Holy Week. The Mass of Holy Thursday would be set at 9 a.m. And then the priest would repose for lunch. And then you would have in the afternoon the washing of the feet, which was called the mandatum, which was a separate ceremony.
So that was separate than the Mass of the Lord's Supper?
Yeah, 100%. It was a completely separate ceremony.
The pre-Vatican II, in the what we call the extraordinary form now, like the 62 and earlier, you never inserted things into the You tried really hard not to insert things into the Mass. So even a nuptial Mass, you would have been married before. And then
Same thing with confirmation, correct? When you'd be confirmed prior to the Mass?
Yes.
Because
go ahead, Matt. I'm sorry.
No, because the mandatum, the washing of the feet, was very much a ceremony. Like in monasteries, it was done by the abbot to the monks for the lunch on Holy Thursday. And in the East, the Orthodox also do it as a separate ceremony.
Hmm.
So you would get up, you'd have the solemn Mass in the morning. The Blessed Sacrament would be reposed on the altar for the reposition. And people would start visiting. And in the afternoon, you'd have which was a big deal. You'd have a little ceremony with the washing of the feet. And you'd have, but there was very much a tradition of visiting multiple altars of repose. Now, you have to remember, this isn't a time when most major metropolitan cities in the U.S. that had a large Catholic population most parish churches were 8 blocks from the other, one from the other. Because the concept was that within 8 blocks, you could really, the church was really part of your daily life. So, you know, grandma got up in the morning and walked the 8 blocks to mass and then walked home. So people, what would happen is now, especially in that kind of setup, people would go from church to church. Some people did 9, some people did 7. It seems, I have a theory, it went all through Catholicism, but it seems to really have taken a strong presence in Hispanic, in Latin countries. But you have to remember that the south of Italy for 400 years was a Hispanic country, was part of the Spanish Empire. So Spain, which is, and so much of the Holy Week tradition, we also got during our union with Spain. Part of Holy Thursday was people had to walk. So the Spanish banned horse riding. You could not ride a horse. So if you were a duke or a prince or a count or a knight, you couldn't. Your horse didn't come out on Holy Thursday. You walked. So I think in Naples there was a phrase called the castrocia. Strocia means like the sound, the rustling sound, like almost like sliding your feet. I don't know what's the word I'm trying to look for in English.
Shuffling
your feet, yes. And the idea was that they called it kind of like the shuffle that night, because people who were used to going by horseback or carriage would walk from church to church to visit the Blessed Sacrament. Now, the confraternities that were created as mutual aid societies during the plague, which did penances, congregational penances during Holy Week, on Holy Thursday, they would lead processions from church to church. So your congrega with the prior and the council would go from church to church and would reverence the Blessed Sacrament. Now, even in the Cilento, they used to do 9 churches, and they would walk all through the night. They would not come home until dawn on Good Friday. So they would go from chapel to chapel. So the confraternity would come in. They would reverence the Blessed Sacrament. Sometimes they would do a symbolic flagellation with the flagellum, with a symbolic whip to commemorate Christ, the scourging at the pillars. At the pillar, they would sing the Miserere, which is Psalm 50, and then they would go to the next church. But that became very much, and what happened is, I remember something also, in some parts of Southern Italy, that was the day you got dressed up with your new clothes for Easter. Remember back then?
On Holy Thursday?
Yeah, some places Palm Sunday, some places Holy Thursday. Because remember, you wore the same outfit every day. So some people, you know, and on Holy Thursday, you would see everyone going from church to church. And also amongst parishes, it was competitive of who had the most impressive altars. Now, also in the
very South Italian.
Italian.
Also, well, it was about Jesus, right?
They would plant, and a lot of places, they would plant wheat seeds around February 2nd, around the time of the purification, the invitation, they would Candlemass. They would plant weed seeds outside of the light. So they would put someplace hot where there was no sunlight, and the grain would grow. The stalks of grain would begin to break through the ground. They would be white. They would be put out for the decoration on Holy Thursday. Because remember something, today we're used to getting roses any time of year we want. Back in the ancient world, you got roses in the month of May or the month of June, depending on where you were geographically. You got lilies in the spring. You didn't have flowers all year long. So people would grow these little wheat plants, put them in front of the Blessed Sacrament, and then after Easter, the farmers would take them home and they would plant it amongst their wheat crops as kind of like the blessed wheat seed to bring blessings for the new year.
Is that like a summer wheat then? Kind of like what, like different wheat, summer wheat, spring wheat?
Yeah, yeah. The wheat that would be, that I guess would be the spring wheat. I think that's when they harvested it. That's the summer wheat. They would take those little plants of grain and bring them home.
Now this was only a Southern Italian tradition?
Yeah, I mean, if it happened in the North, I've never seen it. But I mean, even in Ireland, I mean, other places around the world, people did visit the multiple altars. Now, if you're in a little Alpine village and you're the only church and the next church is 10 miles away, you're not going to be going from church to church.
Mm-hmm.
But even in most European villages, there were multiple churches, multiple little chapels. So Holy Thursday was the day to visit. And the idea was that it was to commemorate Christ spending the night in the Garden of Gethsemane. So, you know, when Christ rebukes the apostles and says, you know, could you not keep watch with me for 1 hour? The idea was that the penance done by the confraternities was to keep watch with Christ for 1 hour.
So so each church or each chapel that the confraternity would go to, they would spend 1 hour with the Lord?
No, I mean, not an actual hour. I mean, if you have walking from village to village to go to the different churches. But I'm saying it was more of a spiritual, symbolic hour.
Okay. And if, for people that don't know, what is a confraternity, Patrick?
It's a Catholic brotherhood of laymen.
Okay.
Like the Knights of Columbus, but in what Patrick's referring to, they would have also had more of a liturgical function. They would have had a devotion to a particular saint, a particular divine mystery, and they would have not just done good works, but they would have promoted that devotion. You know,
okay.
Saint Bernard of Clairvaux had a particular devotion to the wounded shoulder of Christ, right? He had a devotion to Mary. So those are things that if Bernard, when Bernard was preaching among his own brothers and among Europe, because he was a famous preacher in Europe, those were things he would have promoted. So like there's the confraternity of the Holy Face, right? Madonna della Sacromonte, you know, the devotion to these particular things.
So Eric, I want you to jump in here. I want you to talk a little bit we covered Holy Thursday. Let's move a little bit into Good Friday. So I know particularly in Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church in Newark, they would have the procession of the Jesu Mort of the dead Christ, correct? With Our Lady of Sorrows following. So I'm talking to a particular church here, but I know that you have at your church that you attend one of the most beautiful statues of Our Lady of Sorrows that dates back to the original church, correct? So you're talking what, 125 years?
Yeah, I would say at least 125. I mean, the church is 130, so it came very soon thereafter. The devotion comes from Castel Petroso, which is in Molise. And at the time, I mean, it was still Abruzzo and Molise, the region was, before they divorced in the 1960s. But I mean, the story of Our Lady of Sorrows of Castel Petroso is a very beautiful one. She appeared to these two poor shepherdesses. Sheep went lost. She goes in a cave and she sees Our Lady of Sorrows and she's holding the dead body. As a matter of fact, she's looking at him. She doesn't look up, which is very interesting. The pastor at the time at Mount Carmel in 1994, he came from Campobasso, so the devotion to Our Lady of Sorrows quickly took hold, and they were able to purchase the statue. And the one that's there, I mean, her dress, I mean, it's a mannequin, so it's dressed up, resides there. But I think it's also very interesting to note, like, St. Lucy's in Newark also has a beautiful Our Lady of Sorrows. So it seems to be that the devotion to Our Lady of Sorrows is something very prevalent in Italian churches, Italian parishes. I mean, I think all Italians, and Pat could speak to this, of, you know, the suffering of the Italian people and how they could relate to Our Lady of Sorrows in that regard.
Which even like the people from, was it Mola de Bari? They have a devotion to Our Lady of Sorrows as well.
In Sicily too.
Sicily as well.
Sicily Addolorata, yeah.
Madonna Addolorata. It seems to be, once again, something that a lot of people can relate to, you know, the suffering of Mary, and which we try and recreate and emulate every year with our Good Friday procession.
So how can we recreate? Obviously, because we're not going to have processions this year and there's not going to be any kind of real liturgical celebration as a congregation in a church other than through the internet, Facebook, YouTube. How can we then take part in this tradition in our own homes?
That's a very good question. So, I mean, honestly, I'm very grateful to you because you've taken such beautiful pictures through the years of Mount Carmel. So we're actually able to reach out through Facebook to our congregation. And, you know, we're not a very big church, but, you know, we're able to reach out and give the story of Our Lady of Sorrows and have people do some spiritual reading and research and While you can't be there presently in person, for you to be able to familiarize ourselves, because I think that even if we were to have a procession, Anthony, it's like how many people go there and they just follow the motions.
Yeah.
You know, maybe using this as a time to actually look into, well, why do we do the things that we do? And I think reaching out to people in that way so they can become more acquainted with or familiar with our traditions as to why we do certain things, as to why we have processions, as to why they were so common, especially for, you know, Italian-American parishes and Italians in general, to be able to familiarize yourself as to the why. Okay, this is why we do it.
And we're also, it isn't that we're worshiping a statue or we're worshiping a saint, you know. It's, I think, Father, maybe you could talk a little to that point, is that this is it's a devotion. So it's not like we're bowing down to an inanimate object.
Right. So what's the difference between, you know, an idol and an image? Because that's an important distinction. You know, when you have an idol, you know, you believe that that is the God, right? When you have an image, it's a representation for you of something else. You know, I have a beautiful picture, you know, of Patrick and I on the day I was invested in into the Constantinian order. That's not Patrick, right? It's not me, but it's a representation of us. So we have, you know, as we keep family photos around, you know, we keep, this is the Catholic version of keeping family photos, right? So we keep memories before our eyes. So we don't adore a statue. You know, we remember events. We inspire, you know, really education, awareness, catechesis, evangelization, whatever you want, by the processions. Here's you asked a great question. How do we do this at home? There's a devotion to our sorrowful mother, the seven sorrows of Mary, right? So the seven sorrows of Mary are the prophecy of Simeon, right? The flight into Egypt, the loss of Jesus in the temple, the meeting of Mary and Jesus on the way of the cross, his crucifixion. This one is the one that always kills me. The last two is the Pietà, when Jesus is taken down from the cross and that horrific revisiting, I imagine, of the first time in Mary's heart. I imagine she can only think of the first time she held Jesus, and now, you know, this being the last, at least in her mind in that moment, maybe. And then the same way that she swaddled him at his birth, then, you know, to wrap him in linen and to put him in the tomb and to have to leave him, you know. So those seven moments are those, you know, that's why with the image of Our Lady of Sorrow, there's usually seven swords.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what those seven represent. And the tradition is that the Servites started this. The Servite Fathers out of Florence in the Middle Ages. So it's called the Servite Rosary, where you say seven Hail Marys, meditating on these. Some people just say, you know, instead of seven Hail Marys for each sorrow, one Hail Mary for each sorrow. There's all variations. None, as far as I know, right or wrong. But then Mary promises seven graces, right? So by keeping these events in solidarity, you know, they happened for us, right? So we have these processions to make that known, right? We don't do it in such a way as to say this is Mary, right? That this statue has any power. The person it represents, you know, we're showing our love and devotion because we're returning, you know, what she first gave. The great line, there was no way for the Christ's heart to be pierced without it first going through the heart of his mother. Right? You know, and so one of the reasons I think that this devotion is so popular among Italians and Italian Americans is because, think about how powerful a role an Italian American mother has in a household.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the fastest way to get an Italian man to cry is to see his mother cry, right? Yes or no?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. So here, you know, not only do you have Mary, most innocent and most generous, but we know family so well. And what are we always trying to do? You know, we have honor. We protect each other. Italians are fierce about their families. And so here we see God as a member of our family. We see Mary as our mother. And we have this tenderness, to use Pope Francis's word, we have a tenderness towards these moments, because that's, you know, this is where the devotion kicks in, that we understand how the mystery has worked itself out in our lives, because we feel it in our families. We feel it in our love. So how do you do it at home? The seven sorrows, you pray. Those are things to pray every day. Seven Hail Marys, anybody can do that.
Mm-hmm.
The Stations of the Cross, you can do at home. The wonderful thing about all the devotions that Patrick said, and processions and everything you brought up, they're all the things people do. You need priests for sacraments, but devotions are things you can do at home. Again, that separated but not alone motto I want to emphasize for the church right now. We're separated, but we're not alone.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just to piggyback on that, but I think that sometimes, though, because we aren't together as one family in one particular place, we can feel a sense of abandonment in a way, kind of the way maybe Jesus felt on the cross. Mm-hmm. I know you can't compare the two, but to a certain extent in our human minds, we can feel a sense of abandonment or separation from our church family, from our earthly family. So that I think is also something to kind of maybe also meditate on a little bit too.
For sure.
on Good Friday.
Any suffering that you have that makes you feel compassion for the suffering of another is a virtue. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be the same, but whatever, because it brings about compassion, meaning suffering with compassio. If you are now more able to suffer with, then it has been a virtue.
Mm-hmm.
So if we are able to enter into the darkness of Christ's night and of his tomb, if we are able to have a longing that he, it's never going to be the same. But if it motivates, allows me to be more sensitive towards the sufferings of other people, if it makes me more compassionate, then yes, it is a virtue. It doesn't have to be the same thing, right, to bring out my love or my concern. So we'll never know Christ's suffering. But if we can appreciate it, if we can enter into it more, then something good has happened.
Amen. Patrick, can you add anything to Good Friday in the Italian American or the Italian community? Tradition-wise, or
in what sense?
No, I mean, besides the procession of the Sorrowful Mother and Gesù Morto, is there any other?
Huge. I mean, in Italy and in all the Latin countries, in Greece, in warm weather countries, the procession with a representation of a dead Christ, be it a cloth icon for the Greeks, an actual statue. In the Catholic world, in the Mediterranean world, because remember, again, the Good Friday pre-sanctified liturgy would have been at 9 a.m. in the old days. And the afternoon would have been dedicated to processions of the dead Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Even in pre-Reformation England, all the churches in the pre-Reformation England had tombs the way that the Polish do, the dead Christ.
Hmm.
Matter of fact, pre-Reformation England was known for their tombs. If you go into a church in England today that dates from the pre-Reformation period, usually on the gospel side of the altar, there will be an indentation. So on the epistle side, there's an indentation for the priest, deacon, and subdeacon to sit in the solemn mass. On cushions and a little niche into the side wall, on the opposite wall, there was another indentation, a little niche that was for a statue of the dead Christ, which would be decorated profusely for Good Friday.
Wow.
So the whole Christian world, not just the Catholic world or the Mediterranean world or the Italian world, had a deep devotion for the Good Friday procession.
Hmm.
And I think that, the evening of Good Friday anticipated Holy Saturday, and Holy Saturday was the end of the Lenten fast, because pre-1955, the Easter Vigil was on the morning of Holy Saturday. The church bells would ring for the glory at 12 noon. And that would be the end of your Easter fasting. And that's why people would eat beets again on Saturday at 12 noon. That was the Holy Saturday luncheon food.
So there wouldn't be the liturgy with the fire? That would be take place in the morning? The new fire?
Yes.
Yeah. The reason why all these things happen in the morning, because that might be confusing some people. You know, Jesus died at 3 o'clock. We're used to the Passion liturgy being at 3 o'clock. We're used to the darkness and the rising fire on Saturday night. But remember that this began the Easter duty, right? People had just been to confession. The preference towards early morning masses in general, but especially in this time, is for the sake of communion. Because you didn't have a 1 hour fast. You had from midnight fast. So the idea was that you can't have, you know, practically, you know, if the faithful weren't going to communion anyway, then it wouldn't, you know, have had so much of an impact. But you can't have the celebrant passing out because, you know, it's 8 o'clock at night on Saturday and he hasn't eaten since, you know, Good Friday, which was the fast day. So maybe not, you know, the body just doesn't work that way. This is a biological thing, not even a common thing. So you've got these 9 o'clock or early morning things happening so that Holy Communion was a possibility because of the fast pad.
And the Greeks have no Sunday morning liturgy. The Greeks, the Oriental churches, the Eastern churches, they have the Easter Vigil on Saturday night, and they have the Matins, which is where they do the Christos Anesti with the candles. That happens before midnight. Midnight is the beginning of the Divine Liturgy. That goes for like 2 hours. Right. Now you're at 2 a.m., and, you know, it's like my big fat Greek wedding, then they go home and eat lamb. And everybody slept in on Easter Sunday. Where the Roman Catholic priest had to get up and go, you know, count, you know, masses, you know, you had a parish. You know, one parish in the Archdiocese in Newark, a priest who was there in the 50s, they had 14 Sunday masses.
Wow.
Seven in the upper church, seven in the lower church, every half hour. So it was like 5:36, 6:37, 7:38, 8:30. So if you're giving out communion and you're hearing confession, you can't be wiped out from the evening vigil mass for the night before. And also something else, in the medieval world, it was dangerous to go out at night. They were like robbers. And so, I mean, there's a lot of cultural reasons why the Easter Vigil migrated to Saturday morning. But, you know, the Greeks also have a liturgy that they actually celebrate on Holy Saturday. Because Holy Saturday in the morning, because Holy Saturday, Father, you could say this probably better than me, it's kind of like a transition day. It's not quite Easter and it's not quite Good Friday.
There's the best thing that... In the Liturgy of the Hours, in the Office of Readings, the second reading, it evokes such a deep response. It's an anonymous homily for Holy Saturday. We don't know who wrote it, but it's well quoted. Everybody who prays knows it. And it begins with the line, "There is a great silence upon the earth. The King is asleep. He sleeps in the depths of the earth, and the whole world awaits for his waking." So yes, that transition moment, you know, since Pat's talking about the Greeks, when we in the West think about Easter and the resurrection, we think of Christ bodily walking out of the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
The Renaissance loved to paint the moment of Mary Magdalene in the garden, the non tongli me, don't cling to me. But in the East, the moment of resurrection, the image for that is an image called in iconography, the harrowing of hell. It's Christ literally standing over broken chains, and it's very much like, you know, the ninja Jesus, because you imagine that he came with and kicked down the doors to. Not that this is an actual Catholic word, but limbo, you know, wherever the place of the dead, the place of repose, that those broken doors, there's an old man who's under the doors who is now chained. You know, some people say it's the devil. Some people say it's death. Either way, you're right. And Jesus so beautifully, usually with the cross, reaching down with one hand or sometimes with both and lifting up a man and a woman, Adam and Eve. And you see the patriarchs and the prophets and all the righteous, you know, coming out of darkness, streaming towards Christ. You know, so that's why there is this strong tension in the East, in the Eastern Rites, the Italo-Albanian Church, the Byzantine, all of that. Why the night? Because it's when everyone start, when the just starts coming back, when Christ starts rising from the dead, when he begins that journey out of the defunctus, out of the depths. So the moment that Christ turns on his heels to leap, because remember, Christ had a soul, has a soul as a human being. So that soul had to, it's not just that the lungs had to deflate and the heart had to stop and the eyes had to close. It's that for him to experience death, his soul had to go into that place of the dead. But see, because of his immaculate soul, whenever he wanted, he was not a prisoner. He went there freely. We were prisoners. When he chose to turn around and walk out, that's what broke the bonds of death. So maybe I amend my statement. Maybe it's not that Jesus broke in that icon, broke the doors down to get in. Maybe he broke the doors down to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did that, that's the moment of the resurrection. That's the moment that what Patrick is saying they celebrate in the East. That the sense of now we're moving not back to the same, but back to not, because the same, you know, is the original sin. We're not coming back to this world as it was. We're coming back to this world for what it now will be, right? Which includes open door to heaven. So that's why there's the nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
We have different emphasis culturally. The journey of Christ's soul back to the body and back, leading us, right? We emphasize the moment where that body and soul reunited came out of the tomb. Just as St. John Paul II said, breathing with both lungs.
Mm-hmm.
So,
no, this is really, this is great. I mean, I love getting in deep into it because, again, this is some stuff that we don't really know. Maybe we just kind of go through the motions, go into Mass, go into celebrating Easter, but we don't know, I guess, the reasons or the meaning behind all this stuff. So I'm learning a lot here. So I thank all of you guys for that. So we covered Holy Thursday, we covered Good Friday, we covered a little bit of Holy Saturday. So now let's get, I guess, to what we can call the main event, the big day, Easter. So Easter, that is the day of the resurrection. That is the day that the tomb was empty, that Jesus Christ was back. He was back. So let's talk a little bit about liturgically. Let's talk a little bit about it culturally, traditionally, in the Italian American, in the food wise, because really that's when the doors get thrown open, when you get to eat all these crazy foods that we wait all year for. Especially, I want to talk to, because Patrick is the king of Pizzagiana. Pizza Chiana. So I want to talk about that.
How did I get this title? You're the second one to give it to me today.
I'm the second one today?
Yes. It's become like a hashtag. Pizza Chiana.
That's more shocking that this is the second time it's being discussed today.
Rosello Rago also gave me the title.
The king of the pizza game. So let's just talk a little bit about liturgically. So Easter. So I guess we did cover a little bit of it, talking about Holy Saturday.
Yeah.
So obviously, how can we celebrate Easter liturgically at home? Is there some kind of tips and tricks? I know it's kind of a corny way to say tips and tricks, but is there a way that we can get deeper into the mystery?
Yeah. You know what I think? If you're a family, what I think is a perfect way to celebrate this liturgically, because what do we do differently when we're together at Mass on Easter Sunday than we do at any other Mass? We renew our baptismal promises. If you have children, get out their baptismal pictures. Get out the dress. Get out the candle, right? Show them the video. Talk about, you know, get grandma and grandma, grandma and grandpa, nonna and noni, get everybody on Zoom, right? Or whatever, all the, you know, pick a social media platform. What was yours like? What was mine like? Here, you know, the same thing. Oh, this is how we did it. This is what I did with your mother and your father. This is why I did it. Because we're baptized into the death of Christ so that we can rise with him. You know, our baptism is so essential to us. With the resurrection, we renew it. We sprinkle ourselves with holy water. We celebrate the people who have just been baptized. So while that's being held off a little bit, the people are being baptized and received into the church. Why don't we, you know, maybe we don't have any holy water to use, but we have all, you know, we sent you home with all those things, the candle, you have the dress, the white garment, the pictures, you know. So many times, I don't know about any of you, but, you know, my family was so good about taking pictures. And they're so good about making sure that nothing ever happens to those pictures that we've never seen them since. Right? Let's talk about baptism. Let's together as a family, what is that famous quote from scripture that's all over the place? As for me and my house, we choose to serve the Lord. This is a way that we remind ourselves of that. Together as a family, you know, Google Catholic baptismal promises, renew your baptismal promises together. You're going to do it when you're watching Mass, right? Because if we don't do the profession of faith, which is our baptismal creed, we renew the promises. So parents, talk to your kids about it before Mass. Get them ready for it, right? Older children like the four of us, how much do we know about our baptism? You know, this is some of the stuff that's good about this, sheltering in place, is that we're not running, you know, how many of us would be more worried about getting to the pasticceria early enough on Sunday to get the cannoli, the tiramisu, and the cookies? You know, we wouldn't think about our baptism. That's what happens naturally. Now we got to sit around. We have time to reflect. So, like, I know I was a colicky baby. I know I cried my head off the day of my baptism. Maybe it was the exorcism. Who knows?
The devil coming out.
Yeah.
That's my baptismal picture. I don't know if you can see it. It's kind of hard.
I can see it. No, I can see it. That's awesome. That's on your phone. You have it. So
yeah. August 21st, 1982. Wow. Was my baptismal day. Yes.
My parents got married a week later.
Really?
Yeah. August 21st.
Really?
Yeah.
You see, I mean, I think the Pope might have said that a while ago. Like go home, ask your parents when you were baptized.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. I mean, we should that should be a day. That's our second birthday in a way. That's the day that we were welcomed into the church. So we kind of should celebrate it, whether or not we have a cake or not. I mean, I guess we can't. We're Italian, so we have any excuse for a party. So I do want to talk about the foods of Easter. So traditionally, lamb is the big one. But I know, like, so for example, my family, we would make the pizza gain or the pizza chiena. But my wife's family, they make something called panata or empanata, which is a pie stuffed usually with lamb. So you see how there's these different parts of Italy or different parts of the South have different types of pies or different types of dishes. So I want to talk – first of all, I want to talk to your particular tradition. So Father Ed, Eric, Patrick, what are some things that you grew up eating on Easter? So Eric, could you start with we start with you?
Sure. So, I mean, my family in Spieling, I mean, the cuisine is very, very, very primitive, very simple. So traditionally for Easter Sunday, they would have pasta col tagliarini, which is like a thin rolled up pasta. You cut it. It's a pain in the neck to make, but it's like a shredded fresh pasta. And then with your meats, obviously at the end, not together. Traditionally, my grandmother would make it. It was called a campanara, which is like a bell tower, which is so much like the bread that Father was talking about before, but ours is, once again, very simple. It's like just circular, and it has just regular eggs. They're not dyed. So it's just a bread with an egg in it. And then we would have as a dessert called pignolata, which is the Neapolitans would call struffoli.
Okay.
But
differently. Kyle, but is it called a pignolata too? Because I know the Sicilians call it pignolata.
Pignolata, yeah, and it's
Bigger ones or the small ones?
It's bigger, and what it is, it's egg. All it is egg and flour. It's a very simple recipe for anybody that wants it. Egg and flour, as much as it, my grandma would say, quanto di chiama, as much as it calls for, which can be very obscure. So if you do six eggs, then flour relative to six eggs, you fry it in oil, and then you make the syrup on top, which is only water and sugar. And that's mm-hmm. But once again, very simple things.
See, we use honey.
No, we use sugar and water. That's interesting. No, we don't use honey.
We use honey and zest. Yeah.
So, Father Edmund, where is your family from?
Sicily.
Mom and dad?
Yes.
Okay. So what are some of your Easter traditions, foods, and stuff like that?
Well, usually, you know, the pasta we would have is like tortellini and brodo, right? So that's usually the more of the spring thing. I'm a lamb eater. So this becomes a thing with my family. Not everybody's a lamb eater. So some of us, you know, that like it, there's some for us, but usually it's a pork pork dish for the main. And then Nonna's, you know, pizza gaina. But she makes it, I don't know how, she makes it so heavy. She puts so much in it. Some people go like light with eggs and ricotta and then just like sprinkles of meat. I mean, she can't get it out of the car by herself. I don't even know.
Well, I think that's a big – a lot of those things happen because in Italy, food was scarce. And so when people came to America, they could afford all the ricotta, all the sausage, all the salami if they wanted to. So, I mean, if you see the pizza games that are made in Italy, it's a much less – I mean, you have the – I'll say the New Jersey style – huge 1980s, early 80s, late 70s Pyrex dish that you can make the small child in. That's like stuffed with like 18 pounds of ricotta, 36 pounds of salami, 14 pounds. And it's huge. I mean, you could anchor the Andrea Doria with it. It's absolutely delicious. But, it's huge. But that.
I don't know if that's the best thing to, best image of it.
Well, I mean, it's just it's cheese with sausage and.
No, I mean with the Andrea Doria, we, you know, it's not.
Yeah, that's true. That probably wasn't the right choice of ship.
No.
Like
anchoring the Titanic.
That, yeah, kind of like anchoring the Titanic. But that being said, I think that a lot of the foods here, especially when it comes to meat and cheese, are heavy just because we, you know, I saw a video of a pizza game being made in Salerno, in Nuovo Sottosciano, and maybe it was the diameter of two fingers at its highest point.
Wow.
So it was laid out bread, dough, cacio e ricotta, the fresh cheese, the salami, the eggs, hard-boiled eggs, or cheese, all mixed together, put down. Another sheet of dough was put over it, and it was kind of like crumpled.
You lost your Pat. You muted yourself.
Got too excited.
He muted himself. Pat, you're muted. You got to unmute yourself. Uh-oh, maybe you got a phone call.
Who knows? Speaking of, by the way, Monsignor Ambrosio makes the best pastiera.
I know. Really?
We're talking about the savory, but then we're going to get to the sweet, but he makes the absolute best. Oh.
Pat, I think he's back. Pat, you're back?
Yes, I had a phone call coming in, so it blocked out my phone.
Sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I think that if you – did you get the part where I talked about Wilmington?
No, same, you didn't talk about Wilmington.
Yeah, here we go.
Did we lose him again?
Well, the people in Olevino Sultusciano, they have a colony. I'm here. Can you hear me?
I hear you. Go ahead, Pat. I hear you. Patrick. I guess he's on the other line.
Yeah, but he's not muted. Oh, no.
I wasn't muted. It's I have five phones going off at once.
But Wilmington.
That's why I'm doing this in my chapel, because nothing can bother me in here.
I'm not used to the online media world. It's still a curve there.
What is that noise in the background? Is that like telephone, actually a hammer hitting a bell? Like,
I actually have a landline. I don't know if you might remember them. That's when telephones used to be connected with a string to the wall.
Do you have a rotary phone? Bell.
That sounds like Graham Bell's phone back then.
It's a phone I have. That phone is from 1979. I like old phones because they have a great
feel. They're heavy.
Yeah, they have a great I don't know. They sound like 1978.
It's called sentimental.
Sentimental. We should bring back rotary phones. Anthony, why don't you start a campaign, Return of the Rotary Phone?
Hey, I grew up on a rotary phone.
I have a working one if anybody wants it. I don't need
really?
You know, my grandmother.
How did you get a rotary
My grandmother had it. She didn't switch over probably until like 1990, maybe 91. Before she got a touch.
Wow.
Yeah.
I actually know. You want to date me, Father Ed? My grandmother, I used to have to dial the phone for her, and she would tell me, like, all her sister's phone numbers. And, like, Oldfield 6. That was the Jersey City, OL6. And that's why people like you're too young. But I know all the old phone numbers because my grandmother would say, OL6, dial this one, OL7. And that would be there. And you'd hit the – you know, but that's what it is. How do we go from beats to game to rotary telephone?
Because your phone was ringing.
now this feels like an Italian conversation. Because now we started somewhere, we went somewhere else. Now we're talking about rotary phones. We're about to hold the rotary phone. That's why Italians are great. Because, you know, like I was telling somebody, I have people are now in panic mode. They don't have this. They don't have that. My grandmother had everything stored. I have 3 Maxwell House coffee jar, she left me a button.
Wow. You know,
actually makes just button.
Pastry, I know.
Bakery string on.
Yeah, because you can't cut that.
No, you can't cut that.
You can't cut that.
You could not cut that string. That was
what, Patrick? Do you know the origin? We're taking over the Tony Manja show.
No, that's good. Go ahead. This is fun.
The origin of not cutting the string?
You can't cut the pastry string.
Because they were cheap and they didn't want to buy string for the Brajol. There's no symbolism.
Oh,
that was Brajol string. That was my
Yeah.
My grandmother used to wrap that string around a Brajol until I wanted to be the progressive person and got like butcher's string. So you would take that
off
the box, and then I would wrap the string around the Dixon Ticonderoga No. 2 pencil, and that was my grandmother's Brajol string. Bakery string was recycled as Brajol string.
That is awesome.
You know. And then they skip you because they say, don't cut that. That's bad luck. You know?
No, that was, they wanted to scare a little child.
Yes, and it worked because I had, to this day, I can't cut the pastry box open. I have to undo it.
You want to hear a funny story about that? I used to, as a kid, I used to like the windows open in the car. And my grandma's going, no, you can't open the windows. The cops, they pull you over, they'll put you in jail for opening up the windows. She didn't want the breeze coming in the car. And I was like 17 years old with a license. And I said, like, well, we can't open the windows. Like, I was like a teenager thinking the cops going to arrest me from opening up the windows. Because, you know, the Italians love scaring. They love to scare children with ridiculous stories that have nothing saddled in reality.
But it works.
My grandmother used to use the string to tie the Christmas cards, Pat. Do you ever hear that?
Christmas cards?
You know the Christmas cards where you would, like, you know, like in Moonstruck, where you would string them together and you would just...
Yeah.
My grandmother would do that in the living room and make a nice arch with...
That worked. They look like candy canes, right?
Right. Appropriate.
I shouldn't even say this, but I'm kind of in a talkative mood. I remember them.
Oh, yeah. Menes tena, as the Jews say. Why is this night different?
They used to cut out flowers from one set of cards and glue them on the other over people's names and then recycle them. I do remember that.
This comes from poverty. This doesn't come from
poverty. Yeah, but we're the last ones. We're like the last. I remember them using. You know when you would go to the florist to get like Happy Birthday Millie, the little card you would put in with the flowers. I remember Italian people using them as actual birthday cards. The flower little card. That was the Schiaffon Faccia card. That's it. I have total no respect for you at all as a human being because you did something to screw me over, but I'm not going to let you tell people I didn't get you a birthday card. So I'm going to go to the florist and give them 15 cents and get this tiny card that I can't even put your name on. That's a true story.
Leave it to the Italians. But yeah, that's what's great about being Italian or Italian American, is because we have these stories. I mean, you think about other cultures, they don't do these. I mean, I guess they do these crazy things, but we really live it.
We're the synthesis of mental illness.
Matt always says all the time, Anthony, he goes, "Eric, just imagine if we were Norwegian, what would we do?" And it's true.
What are they doing tonight on the Norwegian American podcast?
God only knows.
They're talking about looked fish.
Canned fish. So let's just so if we can let's
so what about Easter?
Yeah, let's reel it back in a little bit. Pizza Gain or Pizza Kiena, Patrick, can you just give us a brief? I know it can never be brief because it's always this is a thousands of years of history. But what is the history, as brief as we can, of a Pizza Kiena or a stuffed bread?
Before 1955, Easter ended, as Father said, with the Easter Vigil, which took place on Saturday morning. So your first meal where you could have dairy, meat, eggs, cheese, you know, dairy, of course, is cheese, was lunch on Holy Saturday. But since for 40 days and change, you had been deprived of all these things, the fasting was so rigorous. People really were run down. And the priest would come during Holy Week, bless the egg, bless the cheese, bless the meat. And the people wouldn't make a pie in Campania. This is really a Campania thing. Parts of Molise, parts of Calabria, parts of Basilicata, absolutely. And very much Campania. They would make a pie of either fresh cheese or ricotta, depending on the area. That's a whole other story for another day. Sometimes chopped up hard-boiled eggs, sometimes chopped up salami, grated cheese. They would bake it into a pie, and then as soon as they heard the bells of the Gloria, at basically more or less on noon on Holy Saturday, they would cut open that pie and break the fast. So Holy Thursday was the fast. On Holy Saturday, the pizza game was the food that broke the fast. Now, when the Reformed Holy Week happened in 1955 and Pius XII had to kind of change the fasting rules, the Holy Saturday fast went from 12 o'clock on Holy Saturday noon all the way to 12 o'clock midnight on Holy Saturday, which is, you know, 12 a.m. On Easter Sunday. And so a lot of people bumped up eating the beets again till Sunday. But the real old way, a lot of families will say to me, we have it on Holy Saturday. But I don't understand why. Maybe we can't wait till Easter. Or, my uncle always had to work driving a bus. And that's not it. The real old tradition is 12 noon on Holy Saturday.
When would you make it? You would make it on Friday?
It depended. You could make it on, Friday, Thursday.
Yeah, we make it on Friday.
That's usually like a penance. You have to like touch the meat, mix the meat with your hands.
Exactly.
Hey, you can't eat it.
See, the Neapolitan Bastiera is a very liturgical pie because the grains are soaked.
Yes.
The grains are cooked on Holy Thursday. So on the, tomorrow is really the international feast day of all priests. It's always Thursday, the feast of the institution, not only of the Blessed Sacrament, but also of the priesthood. Yeah. So the first man. Right. So on Holy Thursday, on Holy Thursday, you would bake a pie with grain that you had soaked, and it would repose Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then you would cut it on Easter Sunday.
Now, what is – so people don't know – I mean, we say grain pie, we say wheat pie, we say rice pie, we say
– you want the differences?
Yeah, so what is the difference? And first of all, what is it? Because we say wheat pie or we say pastiera or, or grano. Okay.
The Greeks – there's history to bastiera. Bastiera is a word in the province of Naples, more or less. 90% of the province of Naples. It's a pie with a sweet pie with grain. If you go into the Baiesa Vesuviana, some of them call it pizza grande, pie of grain. Some parts of the Baiesa Vesuviana around Torre del Greco, they don't make it, they're not grain bastiera people, they're spaghetti pie people. It's a basically sugar, eggs, a little milk, beaten up, baked in a pie with a spaghetti.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into like the area of around Boiano, where Baiano, where our good friend Dolores is from, who's on the Italian American podcast with me, they make a Bastia, and it goes into Avellino, which is a savory spaghetti pie. But the sweet Bastia pie is a pie that's made from soaked grain, ricotta, sugar, eggs. Now, if you're in the city of Naples, they'll use what's ricotta romana. They'll probably use sheep milk. If you're outside, if you're in Caserta, they'll use buffalo milk ricotta. On the Sorrento coast, where my mother's grandmother's family's from, they'll use cow's milk because Sorrento is the Wisconsin, with the Wisconsin of the two Sicilies. They produce all the cow's milk for Naples. In Sorrento, on the coast and into Amalfi, they'll use pastry cream to lighten up the ricotta. In Naples, they won't. Naples, they're very heavy on candied fruits, candied citron. Traditionally, Naples has flavored their pie with orange flower water. Some people use mille fiori water. If you go into the Cilento, they will make a rice pie. But since that was an area of goat milk production, their pizzagaine is made with fresh goat cheese, cacciaricotta, that's chopped up and baked in the oven with salami and the rest. And they make a sweet pie, which is rice cooked in goat milk with sugar. Absolutely delicious. It's kind of like a custard. But even in the Cilento, even now, that's kind of dying out. The more popular pie in the Cilento today is a rice pie, which is basically a Neapolitan bastida. Instead of using grain, they use rice.
So that's not something that came out of like of the Italian American or the Italians coming to America and using what was available to them. The rice they actually made in Italy.
The man who basically wrote the cook for the book on Neapolitan cooking in English, Arthur Schwartz, he had argued in his book that and it was totally understandable why he came to this conclusion that Italian Americans from the Campania region, they couldn't get grain seeds, basically pearled grain. I guess you would say like whole grain berries in the New World, so that they would substitute it with rice. That's not accurate.
Huh?
Certain parts of Campania use rice. The Cilento has always used rice. They do not use grain.
Wow.
As far back as we know, because remember something. We basically can trace these dishes back about 300 or 400 years. Because there's enough of writings around like Bastiera. We have a hard time basically figuring out what did Bastiera mean in Naples in the 15th century. We really don't know, because the oldest Bastiera recipes are savory pies. The same way, like, you know, think about something else. If people, you have to understand Italian food has evolved because tomatoes came from the New World.
Right.
And if everybody know gravy on a Sunday, and you have the Sunday sauce crowd, and who calls it sugo and who calls it whatever. But the tomato condiment that we cook with meat and put on macaroni, pick your noun for it. That's only kind of around since the American Revolution, because before that, in Campania, your meal on Sunday was salted meat boiled with vegetables. The minestra maridata. The minestra maridata is what you eat on Sunday. So you would have a soup of greens and salted meats that were rehydrated from the boiling. That's the tomato gravy, tomato sauce covered macaroni that came later, because you had to wait for the tomato to come to the south of Italy, and B, for someone to figure out, hey, this would probably be really good if we cooked meat in it. So as far as the pies, we know for about 300 or 400 years we can trace back, there's enough of writing to know what was around. If they were eaten, we have some semblances, like for instance, the Neapolitans eat the bastida is a pie made with grain. The Greeks, if you ever go to the Greeks have a funeral after the 40 days of mourning, the Greeks, when they have their month's mind, they have a ceremony where they eat a porridge of grain to celebrate the breaking of the 40 days from the death. We think that might be connected to Neapolitan Bastiera. The Sicilians make something similar to that for St. Lucy's Day.
Mm-hmm.
But
Cuccia. Right, cuccia?
Yeah, but that's savory. That's not a...
But you could also make cuccia sweet. Traditionally, it would be more of a...
It's just, yeah. Because
I know, like my wife's grandmother, Nonna, she puts a little honey on it if she wants it, like, on the sweeter side. If she wants a savory, a little olive oil. I think they even put the chickpeas in it, too, the jeej. You could put that in that, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
But Patrick, so
we all know that the Neapolitan versions of all these dishes are superior to any Sicilian dish. we just know that walking in.
Hey, tranquillamente.
With all due respect.
Because in a way they invented these dishes, whereas the Sicilian, this isn't really a Sicilian specialty, or even a Calabrese specialty, right?
I'm stuck in the middle. No, we don't have any of this stuff. At least where I'm from.
Yeah, I mean, I know. I don't know if it's more of a thing that my wife's family created, but from being in America, but they would make like a rigotta pie for Easter.
Well, no, your wife is from Santa Croce Camarina in the province of Ragusa. There is a history of an Easter pie made with rigotta and lamb.
Well, they make lamb, but they do make the lamb pie. They call it panata or impanata. It's a pie, and it's stuffed with roasted lamb meat. It's absolutely amazing. Now, Father Red, is your family from Ragusa or no?
On one side, yeah. Uh-huh. One side, yes.
And the other side is Palermo.
Palermo.
What's the town?
In Palermo, no, in the city.
Palermo.
Palermo.
And what's the town in Ragusa?
San Giovanni. It's like in the area, right in the area of Ragusa, because it's by the big cathedral.
Oh, but Ragusa Ibla?
Yeah.
That's San Giorgio is the cathedral up there. Beautiful church. Beautiful church. That whole area of Sicily is gorgeous. Southern Sicily. So Pat, before we conclude this, because this is, I'm telling you, you guys are great. I appreciate every minute of you guys coming and talking with me tonight, because I don't know what else I would be doing tonight. I mean, watching TV. Yeah, of course.
Is this on YouTube?
This is on YouTube. Yeah, and then I will put this on to my Facebook and I'll put it on to my podcast page, so it'll be disseminated through many different.
I mean, for those of us who have like 1978 phones that are rotary, we just like to be updated. So it's YouTube.
YouTube. This right now, we're live on YouTube.
We're live.
We're live.
Yes.
Do we know who's listening to us?
Indeed.
Can they wave? No, we can't see them.
We can't do that.
We can't see them.
I've been getting texts from different people. Nobody has commented, I don't think. I don't think anybody's commented.
Are we the only four listening to this? I hope
we're probably the only ones. I think. Although I did get
even
a text
if that's
from my
true,
wife.
I'm having a good time.
Yeah, me too.
Hey, listen.
I got a text. Oh, actually, Father Michael Barone. He texted me. He was listening.
You should have had Father Barone on.
You want
Hello,
me to get him?
Father.
You want me to get him on?
He's the head summit. We'll get him on next time.
Okay, we'll definitely.
There's too many Sicilians on here already. I'm outnumbered.
Hey.
Hey, listen, I'll take your side. We're neighbors.
I hope so, because, you know, Calabrese people, sometimes you go Sicily, sometimes you don't. You gotta watch them. So.
That's true. We go where the wind goes.
You go where the wind goes. That's you true. Sound like Sicilian.
Oh, come on. But Sicilians, there, we're
I could understand Sicilian better than I can understand.
I'm sorry. The kingdom of, it's not the kingdom of the two Naples, all right?
That's true. I'm a double Sicilian, I guess.
You're a double Sicilian. Well, before
next
we wrap
year, God willing, we'll be broadcasting live from the Pasquetta party.
Yes.
When they end the Seder meal, when the Jewish people end the Seder meal, they always say next year in Jerusalem, because they're separated, right? Because mm-hmm. they're not Israel, in the sense of that they were back in the day. So, you know, I think when we, you know, next year, so literally how we're living this, next year, yeah. CMA, you know.
Next year, Jersey City?
Yes.
Come on.
Pasquetta party.
Lindenhorst. The next year, Lindenhorst.
That's a whole other topic, because Pasquetta really is its own other holiday in Italy, which you could probably talk another 3 hours easily on Pasquetta, which
Listen,
means
it little. Makes perfect sense. It's a holiday to rest from a holiday. That's a very Italian thing to do.
It's a very Italian thing to do.
But
I want to say also tonight, before we close, our sympathies go out to the Martino family.
Yes.
Absolutely.
We all our hearts were broken today.
Big time.
Yes. Oh yeah. I'm representing right now. My
hope is the man of faith that Vincenzo Martino was, that he celebrates this year Easter at the table of the Lamb.
Amen. Yeah. Amen to that.
So
Father, can you give us a blessing before we close up?
Absolutely. The Lord be with you.
With your spirit.
Let us pray. Heavenly Father, as we prepare ourselves to enter more deeply during this time into the mystery of your Son's death and resurrection, he who willingly handed himself over to the hands of wicked men, so to endure the cross so as to break our bonds, we ask that you fill us with that new life that is so plentiful in your Son, so that we might truly not just celebrate his resurrection as a holiday, but we might live in that joy and hope that faith brings. Keep us and all our loved ones and the whole world safe from the evils of pandemic. Support those who are working so hard to defend and save us and care for us. And Lord our God, increase our gratitude for them and for you. May all those who this night are lonely be comforted. Those who this night are sad be given great hope and strength. And may we who know of your love always keep it as our most valued of possessions. May your grace and peace descend upon all, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen. That was beautiful. Thank you so much, Father. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so very much for taking time out again to come on the show to talk about our traditions, about Easter, about being Italian American. This is great, and we definitely have to do it again. I do have one announcement. On Monday evening, I will be interviewing Bishop Frank Caggiano of the Diocese of Bridgeport. So I'm looking forward to that. That'll be Monday evening. It'll be live. It won't be live. I'll record it, and then I will post it on all of my social media outlets. So I am looking forward to speaking to Bishop Caggiano about the pandemic, about Easter. So it'll definitely be a must listen to or must see if you're on YouTube interview. So again, thank you so much, Father Ed, Eric, Patrick. You guys are all the best. I love you all. Have a very happy Easter. Buona Pasqua. Buona Pasqua to your families. And we will see you soon here at the Table with Tony. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Ciao for now.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
At the Table with Tony would like to thank its sponsors. Rocco Muriale, Rob Quick, Joseph Cirillo, Raymond Guarini, Tom Gilmore, Oli G, Peter Ziza, Brian McGuire, Peter Ferreira, Rich Ottenstrauer, Anna Mavrianos, Antonio Pepinella, Anthony Ferraro, Sandra and Bob LaMotta, Mike Guero, the Italian Enclaves Historical Society,